If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret, searching for the sound. This is the Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
Wanted to let you know that the Sound Stream is now available exclusively on the Sound app. You can now listen 24/7 to a music stream featuring jam bands and more, much more. So not just what you'd expect, but a few surprises along the way too. Curated by the Sound Media Team, the stream offers up your favorite songs by your favorite bands and artists, both live and in the studio. We'll also be adding specialty programming and much more. So get it today and listen wherever you want for free. Get the app for iOS and Android by searching for The Sound Podcast and Stream or at app.thesoundmedia.com. Just hit the orange button, press play, and boogie on. The show starts now.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Money's No Option from Circles Around the Sun from their self-titled forthcoming third release. It's an interesting time for Circles Around the Sun, having tragically lost one of the founding members, Neil Cassell, this past summer. I was curious how the band and longtime friend Adam McDougall was coping with what must be a series of emotions ahead of the release of this third record, which naturally has guitar player Cassell's work all over it. We caught up with Adam just before the Circles Around the Sun gig at the St. Clair in Cambridge, Massachusetts. While our heartfelt conversation covered several different topics, including the release of this very peppy record, it started sadly with Cassell's passing.
We really kind of didn't think it was going to happen, obviously, in the aftermath of the event. I think everybody put it to bed, but he had asked specifically to have us finish the record and continue on. So we had to keep working on the record, which was only sort of three quarters of the way done at that point. And yeah, it's very emotional to play these tunes without him, or the feelings that it conjures up. It's they're heavy, heavy nights. And there are people I see in the audience that are crying and stuff, but at some point, about a month after it happened, we kind of started talking about the fact that it was our favorite band, and it was something that we had all been working towards for years, not being sidemen and not working for anybody else and working for ourselves and having something that we loved and something that we really brought us joy every time we got on stage, and the freedom that comes with this project and the instrumental aspect of it, and being able to kind of make all, you know, the kind of records that we want. And we kind of all agreed that we just don't want to stop playing this music. So, so we kept going, and it's been good. It's obviously really hard to I'm reminded of it every day anyway, but doing this is certainly all around you. But it's nice to be with people who we were all close together. So in a way, being on the road and playing these songs is a comfort, even though it can be sad. It can also be beautiful, and it's a comfort to be around the people that you don't even have, you know, we don't even really talk about it much just because we all know it. It's just there. It's not like we're, you know, if I was off doing another gig with a bunch of other people and I was having a sad day because of Neil, and they wouldn't understand, you know? I mean, they would be empathetic, but they wouldn't actually understand the loss. Whereas everybody that I'm surrounded with now completely viscerally understands it, and it's still a family. We just lost a member, you know, but sometimes it's nice to be around your family as opposed to being around strangers.
Yeah, I'm sure it helps with the grieving process for everybody to be, you know, so close and so involved in this band, because you are, you know, the three of you and then the rest of the crew and stuff. So I can imagine it's also great to have people who knew Neil and people who were part of this, you know, all the way through, being able to comfort one another, right?
Yeah, and even, you know, we're playing with Scott Metzger, who's incredible on guitar. Yeah. He's a joy every second, and a challenge to meet his level of playing and his thoughtfulness and all that. And you know, Neil was a big fan, and they knew each other, so it's all still in house, and so it's good. It's I'm glad, because these songs are our babies, and we're all very proud of the records, especially this one that's about to come out. And so I'm glad that there's at least, you know, everyone that I've talked, I'm sure there are people out there that are probably like, how dare they? But for the most part, everyone I've talked to has been supportive, and you know, if the shows weren't good, then that would be one thing, but you know, still the three of us that have that really know what we do and how to play together. And when you add a great musician like Scott, or we had, you know, Eric Krasno before and maybe again, and it's a bit of a revolving door right now. But when you add people like that into the mix, it's it just works. They're not trying. They're strong enough in their own playing that nobody's trying to pull a Neil or do something or try and copy a vibe. They just say, okay, this is my vibe, and I'm going to play your tunes this way. And it's refreshing.
Let me jump off on that, because I've had a chance to listen to the band with Kraz and with Scott, both friends of the show and great musicians. And they both bring different elements to the table. Is it, and first of all, they bring different elements to the table from one another, and certainly different elements to the table from Neil. Is it a case where you have them listen to the records, or give them, I don't know, sheet music to learn this stuff, and then just say, make it your own at this point?
We have been giving people a couple of live shows with Neil that we think were really good. And then, of course, the record's available for them to check out, whatever they want to do. But yeah, any time someone comes in, the rap I give is the most important thing, is that you get to do what you want and be who you are and let the band morph around you, as opposed to the other way around. Which I think is important in this music, because it was always about that. It's very free. You know, there's melodies and there's heads and there's bits we all have to get to at the same time. But oftentimes, you know, there's five to 8 minute periods of do what you want. So it's important. It's really important that the person who's doing that doesn't feel as though they have to play in a box. Otherwise, this will never work.
At the first night of the Brooklyn Bowl shows just last weekend, you played a new tune. Was that a new tune that you had recorded or thought about previously, or was that totally new with specifically Scott for that show?
No, that's a tune from the new record.
Oh, okay.
But that was the first time we played it.
Got it.
Where there's a handful of tunes that we had thrown out to Scott to see that we can kind of work it up, because we haven't had any rehearsal for this. So just, and it's 10 shows in 10 days. So it's not like we have a day off to sit in a hotel room and work stuff out, but we're doing everything at sound checks. So we'll have, you know, an hour or two to set up and make sure everything works. And then hopefully half an hour, 40 minutes to just play, and we can work on stuff. So we're working things up, as we go. So yeah, we had actually did another new one last night in Vermont. And oh no, wait, was that the first? No, actually it might have been first Brooklyn show was the first of one, and then the next Brooklyn show we did that plus another.
Got it.
And then last night we just did both of them. But yeah, it's interesting, because obviously the record had some pretty gaping holes in it. We got a good day of Neil's overdubs and some really amazing solos from him, but I know that had we continued post-production with him, there would probably be more we would have got from him.
Right.
So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of keyboards on this record, because I didn't really want to bring in another guitar player just to fill space. I didn't want people wondering who was playing what. So I wanted every guitar moment on this to be Neil. So yeah, the new record's a bit of a challenge live for me, at least, because I need an extra set of arms.
But that's the way you've played anyway. You always need a set of an extra set of arms. I mean, you always play too many instruments all at once, and we love you for it. But it's pretty amazing what you can accomplish on your own up there. Before we get to the new record, because I do want to talk about the new record, the plan is to continue to sort of have rotating chairs for 2020 until you make a...
F- for a bit. I mean, the guys we're playing with are epic, and because they're so epic, they have other things. You know, they're sought after. Mm-hmm. So to do the amount of work we'd like to do, it may not be possible, but we'll see. Every time we do a tour, you know, every time someone settles into something, it's one step closer to them maybe going, you know, hey, I'll carve out some time, and we're hoping that that will happen. And I can't say for certain, but me personally, I would rather have somebody who's mainly there before we get into another record.
Right.
I'm not sure I want to be doing the guest spot, rotating guitar suite for a record, but it's been working out so far. We've been really lucky. Crash is great. Scott's great. Between the two of them, it's pretty much well covered.
Yeah.
And
it sounds great.
Scott is yeah. I mean, Scott really is an incredibly thoughtful player, which and so is Crash. Neil and I both aren't very technically proficient players, so oftentimes we do a little more writing than we do just soloing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Try and write parts on the spot and try and build on that, and Scott's really adept at that stuff, and he's very thoughtful, and yeah, so is Kraz. It's just that thought. Neil was a very thoughtful player. He would think about what he was doing before he did it, and both those guys are That's a you know, sign of a good player. You don't just get up there and start playing all the hot licks, you know.
Yeah.
Sit back for a second.
The comment I made to your manager or your publicist was that I thought that Scott plays a little looser but with as much intent. And it's a little bit different than Kraz, I think. That was the one comment. Like, I thought,
oh yeah, they're two different. What's cool about it, and you know, just from my own selfish perspective, is that with one band, I have two bands.
Right. Yes.
Because we end up playing so differently depending on who is in the chair. That it's kind of having two bands in one.
Right. When we spoke about Let It Wander when it first came out, or just before it came out, we talked about how involved you were in the process and how much, how prevalent the keyboards were in and on that record. And I think you mentioned at the time, and I'm not quoting you exactly here, but one of the things was that Neil kind of pushed you, I think, to have more keyboards and to do more things on Let It Wander. That's certainly the case. And you know, now I have a pretty good idea of why that is the case on this third record. But is that kind of the way this thing is headed, where there's a lot more keyboards? I mean, Dan is still so sweet in the pocket, and Mark's great too, but there's a lot of keyboard lines.
And you have a copy of the new record, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's for, you know, two reasons. This wasn't a decision that Neil made that moment, you know, it wasn't a moment in time. This is something he had been working up to, for a long time. He was aware that this was the inevitable conclusion, and it was just a matter of when. And in hindsight, this has all become painfully clear. But yes, making the record, he didn't really have a lot of songs or anything. You know, like, the record date was approaching, and I kept saying, "Man, what you got? You got anything?" And I think in his mind, he was already possibly kind of checked out. Not as far as playing goes. He played great on everything. But I think he was passing a torch to us, kind of being like, you guys have to handle this yourselves, and I will play my best on anything you guys have. So this record was written on a lot on keyboards. And like I said, there was some pretty open tracts of land on these tunes that I didn't want to have another guitar player get to. Like I said, I didn't want any confusion as to who was playing guitar. And on his last record ever done, I just thought, you know, I just want him. So there's a lot of keys on this because we had to fill it up. But we also had agreed early on, well before, you know, that happened, that the next record we made, we wanted it to be way more dancey.
Yes.
We just found that after trying to write set lists all last year using stuff from the first two records, that a lot of that stuff is can be a bit mid-tempo-y and a bit plodding, which is great, and we can do it.
Right.
But sometimes it can be very limiting to a set list because there are definitely a bunch of tunes you can't put next to each other. Otherwise, you're just in a slump for you know. And the tunes being anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes long, you do two songs in the same tempo, that's half an hour right there. So we wanted to have some, we wanted to switch it up and get some up-tempo things. We talked about using drum machines and getting a little crazier with the string synth stuff and just bringing in that kind of, I don't know, late 70s sort of disco ball, have a good time thing, which is kind of ironic because, of course, this is now the record that we made our party record, and, of course, it's a tragic, a tragic situation. But this is our party record.
Yeah, and you know, nothing comes in very long. I mean, it is all tight. I mean, I could imagine when you're filling out set lists and you have to go from Saturday's Children, which is long, or Gilbert's Groove, which is long, or anything off the first record. I mean, it is, like you say, I mean, it's a stop down. I mean, there's nothing you can do, right?
Yeah, and this record is because a lot of the writing was done from, like I said, from sort of my keyboard perspective. A lot of it's kind of, I would say, I don't know, more composed.
Mm-hmm.
They're almost, this is kind of like our pop dance record, if you can equate it to that. It was willfully composed and willfully made to be something that's short. I mean, look, in comparison, our Let It Wander was seven songs on two discs. So we've got seven songs on one disc, so we've cut out 50% of the fat.
Right. And it was a different purpose, right? I mean, the first record had a very specific purpose to fill time. And so those jams had to be way longer, and they had to fulfill the purpose of being set break music.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a little bit different than...
I mean, to be fair, that was like Neil and I were just pulling out our hair making that first record because it was, they wanted 5 or 6 hours of music in 2 days.
Right.
So we were, you know, we were purposefully really trying to just be like, all right, you know, we're out of gas. Where do we go? Like, gotta keep going. And, you know, I think I talked about it maybe with you, but that record wasn't meant to be a record. It was just meant to be filler music that we didn't think anyone was going to listen to. So, so it kind of turned around on itself, and then we ended up putting out a record. But that was the intent to that was to be to sort of stretch as much space without having anything poke out and be obvious.
Right.
So that people can have their conversations and buy their beer and buy their t-shirts and whatever they have to do and just have something cool bubbling along in the background. The next record, we kind of started off with that mindset with a bit more composed material. And then Neil and I had a chance to do overdubs, which we hadn't had a chance to do on the first record because we had no time.
Right.
So things got a little more sculpted and we put a lot more time into the icing. And then this time around, we knew what we were going to do. So there's a lot of icing on this record. And the intent of it is more, in my mind, about the songs, the melodies, and having songs be, you know, 7 minutes instead of 19.
Yeah.
And nothing, I'm not saying like, you know, that's our goal for the future. Everything's going to get faster and shorter. It's just, this was an intent for this record. And we can go back. Because the Joe Russo EP was way more sort of, or like Bitches Brew thing. You know,
yeah.
It was like that was basically 3 hours of straight jamming that we just whittled into stuff in the editing process. That was like a nod. We didn't stop with Russo.
He doesn't stop. So you just sat down and those songs just came out of jams. We didn't have a chance to talk about it, obviously, because it was so close to when the record came out, so close, unfortunately, to Neil's passing. But those were just songs that came out of jams with Joe. Is that the idea? Did you have stuff ready to go for that?
One song, the first song, When I Was at Peace, that was actually a piece I had. Then we tried it for hours and tried to work it out and get fancy with it and all this stuff. And Russo was great because he was just kind of patient with us. And we were just listening back to a take. And then he goes, guys, you know, fuck this. Fuck being precious with this stuff. Come on, like, get out of your chair. Let's go in there. Let's just play the song. And then we're not going to stop playing. We're just going to play the song and see where it goes. And we played the tune and kept going for another 2 hours and a bit. And then later on, we just went back to those jams after the song and sort of went, okay, where's a good starting point? Where's a good ending point? Like, enter and exit strategy. And the other three tunes were just bits that made sense from the jams.
He's not just an amazing drummer. He has an amazing ear for production and for what things sound like. I mean, he's just... Have you met many people like Joe in terms of being able to be capable of those sorts of things?
No, he's fantastic. He's so musical. This is going to sound bad to drummers. I'm not going to say it. He's more than a drummer. He's a whole package, and he's got a great bedside manner. I mean, he's the cat that convinced us to go in and do really great performance, because he kind of rallied us when we were all sitting in our chairs slumped down, like, we're not getting it, we're not getting the take, this is a waste of time, we're spending all this money. And he's like, fuck you guys, like, come on, like, get in here, let's go. He like whipped us into shape and like got it going. He kind of ruled that session, and it's because of him that we ended up with all the stuff that we had, which I like that record. It's an interesting, like I said, when you like, that's case in point. I mean, throwing Russo in the mix made the band be completely different.
Right.
We played like, you know, nothing on the new record is anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because we had Russo, and we were like a chameleon band. We do what we do, but to a certain extent, if you have somebody else in the room, we'll start putting on their clothes, you know?
Well, it's because each of you are such amazing musicians, and, you know, not to blow smoke up your ass, but you can be chameleons because you are, well, all, you know, the three of you have such varied backgrounds and such varied skill that you are able to turn on a dime and move things around if you have to, right?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. I mean, it's, and also sticking to your guns. I mean, Dan is chameleon-like, but you can always tell it's him.
Mm-hmm.
Mark can do other stuff, but I know his touch. I can tell if he plays on a record, if you put it on for a second, I can say, oh, I know that's Mark. He's a, you know, some drummers play drum. Some drummers make drums sound a certain way, even if it's someone else's kit.
Right.
Same with pianists. I mean, it's incredible with a piano, which is such a mechanical instrument. You know, you wouldn't think that someone could have their own voice on it. You would think the piano itself would dictate the sound. But anytime you hear Monk playing, you know it's Monk.
Right.
Not just from the harmonic structure, but just the way the piano sounds. And same with Keith Jarrett or Herbie Hancock, any of those guys, Glenn Gould, any, you know, it's like they can all sit at the same Steinway, and the piano will sound different. And it seems impossible to me. It's just a mechanical thing. You're not even touching the strings. It's not like a guitar. I get that. Like, your fingers are actually on the strings. Of course, the you know, your body is changing the sound. But with a piano, you're so far removed from the actual sound. There's a million moving parts before you get to strike a string, you know?
Yeah, it's the touch, right? I mean, it's the feel, it's the flow, it's the way... Like, similar to a drummer, it really is the feel and how much or how hard you hit a key or whatever, and what you do in between.
Yeah, and how you hit it and how it just, it's, I mean, really, case in point, I mean, you know, Monk, obviously. I mean, so it's like, you know, as soon as he just play a chord, it doesn't even have to be one of his, you know, kind of obtuse, right, humorous lines that, of course, you'd know. But just, he can just be comping, just playing straight chords, being as in the box as possible. But the sound of the piano, you just go, whether it's an upright or a grand or whatever it is, it's that's Monk.
There are other bands in the scene that are instrumental bands that do have a similar configuration to yours, but there's only one Circles Around the Sun sound. I mean, when you put on Money Is No Option, when I heard it for the first time, or Baby Man for the first time, I knew right away that it was you guys. What is that? What is the secret ingredient to sounding like Circles?
I will go ahead and say I think it's Dan.
Really?
I mean, he's just got such a different concept of bass playing. Because he can do the simple, you know, laying down a bass line thing, and then he can just go off all up and down the neck, and it all works. But he's really unafraid of making decisions, musical decisions, and sticking to them. He has no qualms about that, which is a beautiful trait. And sometimes I can do it. Sometimes I'll start something and second guess and go, oh, you know, but he's loud and proud and just goes for it. So, and then, you know, I don't really change my rig very much. It's going to always be a Rhodes and a Mini Moog and a clavinet.
Yeah, thank you. I like that.
Yeah. So I think that's probably part of it. I mean, each of those records. I mean, we had B3 and some stuff on the first two, but it's always going to be, you know, Rhodes, clav, Mini Moog, and some sort of string machine, maybe an organ, but probably not. I find B3 really puts you in a box. I love playing B3. Don't get me wrong; it's one of my favorite things to play. But it can often, everyone's so familiar with that sound, Hammond through a Leslie. It's like it's on so many records. It's on everything. It really puts you immediately into a place. As much as everyone wants to use it because it's such a great sound, I definitely on this last record said no, I'm not going to do that. If we're going to have any pads or things that are organ-like, I'm going to do it with a string machine. Just to stay clear of that, like, you know, kind of gospel rock or the thing that, every, you know, everyone uses a B3.
Southern rock, gospel rock. The Rhodes keeps making appearances, though, not just on your record. And it immediately feels like, at least for somebody who, I mean, I was really young in the 70s, but it just feels like immediately a throwback sound to all of those great 70s records. I mean, it just, there's something about the Rhodes, and I can't explain it to people. I've tried to explain it to people, but there's something about the Rhodes over the clav that, you know, just really excites me. Do you feel the same? Do you feel differently? Like, why the Rhodes over, you know, any other kind of electric piano?
When I was coming up as a kid in New York, it was at a time when nobody wanted a Rhodes. They were just too big and heavy. There were all these new keyboards coming out that could fake things, and everyone was really into that stuff. And I had recorded at a studio that my friend was working at, and we would go record there at night because he had keys, so we'd get in and do that. And I was fascinated by, and what really hit me to all those keyboards was those, you know, those cool records that would list everything. They stopped doing that. You know, they would say Herbie Hancock plays Fender Rhodes, Hohner D6, ARP 2600, ARP Odyssey. Like, they list everything, and that's how I figured out, like, what's what. And then they kind of stopped doing that. It'd just be, you know, keyboards by so-and-so, and you wouldn't know what's on there. Like, I hear all these keyboards, but what are they, you know? And so I always knew about the Rhodes from Herbie and you know, a lot from Pink Floyd, too, because Richard Wright was a huge cat for me. And all the Electric Miles stuff with Keith Jarrett and all that, you know, and Chick Corea and stuff, they were playing Rhodes. And that always, I opened it up at that studio and said, okay, that's what this is. Great. And started playing one. And then found that you could buy them for $50 at any music store because they just had rooms in the back. They would be a story high, floor to ceiling, packed with Rhodes. And they're like, fucking please take these things because people are just bringing them in. People are buying a DX7 and bringing in their Rhodes. And they're like, we have too many of these things. Nobody wants them. So I ended up just having a lot of them, figuring out how to fix them and work on them and change things out and make them the way I wanted. And so I just stuck with that. I've been playing those since I was a kid. I'm like 14 or something. So,
yeah, I guess you and Marco are probably of the same vintage. And Marco's the same way with his Rhodes. I mean, he does all kinds of modding to Rhodes's. Rhodes's.
Yeah. I love Marco, man. We just did a little thing in Colorado with Mark and me and Reed Mathis.
Wow.
Just because we had played a show the night before and Marco was playing in Denver. And our publicist, Kevin, also manages Marco.
Mm-hmm.
So we just hit him up and said, man, if you guys don't have an opener, we're going to be in town. We don't know what we'll do, but if you want a little three-piece to just, like, you know, open for you guys. And they were like, yeah. So, and I went, you know, obviously I was there and we played our show and it was great. Reed Mathis is amazing and it was fun. I was just off the cuff. Like, we spent an hour or two, like, before the show just trying to figure out what to do and then did it. But Marco destroyed it. I mean, he really blew my mind. Like, really, I mean, I've always loved his playing, but he did some stuff that night where he really, really kind of ripped my face off.
Do you think about what he's doing and try to, I don't want to say rip him off or copy, but do you think about some of the chord progressions or some of the things that potentially you can pull off? Are you constantly learning?
Yeah. I mean, Marco's a real pianist.
Right.
There's a difference. I'm like a keyboardist. I'm great with, you know, clavinet's probably my thing. Like, I've kind of figured that beast out, like all the different things you can do with it. Because, you know, it's a giant guitar, so it's got huge pickups in it, so you can make it feedback, you can make it do all these things that you can't get from a fake clavinet.
Right.
So it's that's probably my main thing, and Rhodes and some of the synth stuff. But Marco's a pianist, which is a whole different beast. And when you see him really get down on the piano side of things, it's I couldn't copy him. I just don't have the
chops.
I don't have the years and years of being a pianist. I have years and years of being an organist and keyboardist and stuff. So I couldn't copy, but I really appreciate what he does. He's a beast. But yes, I wish I could copy stuff. I mean, I think Neil and I always used to talk about this as people who didn't practice a lot and, like, you know, kind of leaned on the fact that being in a band was cool and you could get by on just, like, what you know, and as long as you have a sound, is kind of making your own sound sometimes comes from, and this may be a cop-out, but sometimes comes from trying to figure out how to play other people's stuff, but you just can't do it. So you come up with your own way of trying to do it, which is not right. but then it becomes your sound.
Right.
Becomes your thing. And, you know, in a perfect world, yes, I should be practicing 3 hours a day or more and, you know, learning new stuff all the time, but I don't. And if I wanted to play like Dr. John or Professor Longhair, I can't do that, but I've come up with a passable thing that I think kind of, you know,
yeah. And then I don't think you're giving yourself nearly enough credit.
Well, those guys, well, I mean,
No, I'm not. I'm yeah, I get it. But I think I don't think that it comes off that you're not, you know, I think you're more than competent.
No, that's what I'm saying. That's the genius of what Neil and I could do is, like,
right.
It's, you know, you're not that, but you manage to do something that people go, oh, I wasn't expecting that.
Right.
And then it becomes sort of interesting. It's not right, but it's interesting. And then that becomes like your signature. It's kind of like, all right, well, that's what procrastination gets you.
This album comes out next week, as we mentioned. It is
Friday the 13th.
Friday the 13th. Now, there is a rumor that if you go to your shows, there is some contraband around.
Yep.
So if people are going to see Circles, they can grab some contraband early, which is
absolutely
very cool. Seven tracks, you're playing stuff from Let It Wander, and you're playing stuff from the first record as well.
Yep.
Are you and you're also you're not doing these true to the album either. You're stretching them out a little bit in the live setting as people would like.
There are a couple of tunes from the new record that Jeff, we do stretch. We stretch the sections that are freer.
Mm-hmm.
We stretch, but there are definitely a handful of tunes from this new record that are pretty composed. We can stretch the solo sections, but there aren't there's not as much bits where it's a complete free for all.
Right.
There is still some structure, and I like having that because we have a lot of tunes that are very free, and it's nice to have some tunes that are, you know, counted off, and we play the tune, and it is a real constructed, worked out piece of music with how, you know, melodies and bridges and choruses and everything. It's fun. It can be really fun to have both. To go from a song from the first record, which is kind of a one chord jam, and it's like, as long as we hit these four sections at some point at the same time, then we're good.
Yeah.
And then we go ahead and play another song where it's like, no, everyone's got to be like, take a breath and be like, all right, this is composed. Like, we're playing a composed piece now. So it's great. It's really nice to be able to do both.
The plan is to continue touring this record probably into the spring, obviously, and I'm sure some festival dates.
A big fall tour if we can.
And a big fall tour, and you don't know yet what's going to happen next, right? I mean, this is still sort of up in the air a little bit in terms of another record, or I mean, obviously the band is.
No, I wouldn't.
No.
I wouldn't say it's up in the air. No, not in my mind. I love this band. I think it's, unless the world just refuses to accept it, as long as people come out and want to see it and do it, we'll do it, and we'll make more records. And I look forward. I really hope, you know, to write with some of the great people we're playing with and see what they bring to the table. And every record's been really different. And I would like to continue that every record is a, you know, sort of concept it's a concept. It's kind of a small concept. Like this last one, like I said, was just dancier and a little more crystally and sheeny and fun.
Right.
That's about as far as the concept goes. But yeah, we just keep
plugging away.
And there's always, you know, every time we have a sound check and we record the shows. So it's almost like every time, if there's a great jam in a show that came out of nowhere, we can kind of go back and say, man, that's the start of a song. You know, let's take that and see where it goes. So it's pretty unlimited because we all really enjoy playing. It's never ever with this band been a, you know, like, oh man, just get to the gig and get back to the hotel. You know, and I've played with situations where it's a little bit like that, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is always, how can we get to that point? Can we get to that high place where everyone's got a huge dopamine hit, you know, and the audience feels it and everyone's in this loop of dopamine and everyone's happy. Like that's what you want. So,
yeah.
We're still constantly striving for that, so it kind of makes it easy. It's not hard to put tunes together with this because they just—it's good people, and everyone's got the right intent, and everyone seems to innately know what's appropriate. or if it's not appropriate to back off and not no one's ever told anybody what to do ever.
Wow.
With this. So yeah, no, and even stuff that I have written as a piece that I'm like, this is a finished piece. I'm still not going like, Dan, you got to play this, or Mark, you play this. You know, it's kind of like, hey guys, what do you think of this? And then we just start playing it, and it usually in the first couple minutes falls into what it's going to be without any major wrangling.
You mentioned that you've had three or four, because if you count the Russo EP being very different too, concept kind of records. Have you thought about vocalists ever? Have you ever considered that? Or even, you know, I think of one for Chuck and just how cool it is to have Chuck, you know, even somebody rapping, or like, have you thought about that? Or is that so far out of left field for this band?
No, it's not. We've thought about that many occasions. We actually thought for a while, not that anyone's expressed interest, but if anybody who sings wanted to have our sound behind them, you know, we could be band for hire for someone who wants to sing. And you know, up until Neil passing, there was definitely talk between Neil and I, because he sings beautifully.
Yep.
And I can sing, so there was a moment where we were thinking, all right, we're going to try and bring in vocals, and what would that look like? You know,
right.
It can't be singer-songwriter stuff. It can't be introspective. Oh, my girl left me, or oh, I'm so happy, I'm in love. And, you know, it can't be about the singer. It has to be more of that sort of Floyd thing where it's stuff.
Right, or Rush, right, 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 yeah.
Yeah, like outside concept. It's not interior, it's exterior. You're writing about the world,
yeah,
not about yourself. And so we definitely thought about it. And we were talking with Dave Schools a lot because he was interested in helping out and stuff, and still is. And he was really trying to push, you know, like, you guys should come up, even if it's just oohs and ahs, or just very, very, like, big concept but limited words. Maybe, only, you know, you don't have to sing a whole song. You could just have a bit of the song that's sung, and it has some sort of concept that resonates with the world, as opposed to resonates only with the singer, you know.
Hmm.
And so, yes, we were definitely thinking about that. But, you know, Neil's passing put that kind of to bed for a bit, because he was the obvious choice as being, you know, we could sing harmony together all night, but he would still be the lead. You know, he's got the voice. So now we don't have that option within the band, but we're not opposed to you know, somebody says, man, I love the way your band sounds, I want you to do tracks, just come in the studio and jam for a couple of days, and that person can sort of cut up what we do and use it to their advantage. We're not opposed to that in any regard. And, you know, singing is fun. It's also fun to not have to sing, because just on a selfish level, everything kind of sounds better when you're not trying to push vocals over the music, you know, in a live setting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, the fact that we don't have vocals kind of makes it easy. We can just be like, we can sound really good and be really loud without having to worry about monitor feedback or a singer not being able to hear themselves, or all the drum cymbals coming through the singer's microphone and messing, you know. So it's very, it's like, you know, it's like playing in a club or playing like a boombox or something. Just, we can always have our tight sound that we like every show, no matter what the club is. It just makes it easier.
I've kept you for way too long.
No, I'm fine. We're just setting up here.
What's Neil's legacy now that, you know, time has passed? What's ultimately, you think, and, you know, this record probably being one of the, I know that there's a solo record that he was working on too. What is Neil's legacy, not just to this band, but to the scene, as somebody who knew him so well? What do you think his lasting legacy will be?
Well, just as a person, empathy. He was just a very empathetic. You know, so many people were touched by him, even if they only hung out with him for an hour or less. He was kind of like a sponge for people. I think he really put himself out there in a way where he really listened and understood, even if it wasn't in his wheelhouse. He really strived to understand what it would be like to be that person, not what it would be like for that person to relate to him. You know, he wouldn't necessarily all... A lot of people see everything through their own lens. So if someone's going through something, it's like, oh man, I get it. I went through something like that. But that's not really connecting with the person. You know, you're bringing your baggage into it and saying, oh, I went through something, now let's talk about me, you know. And he wasn't like that. And that's a rare trait. Or you can really be in a place and he would be like, I understand what you're going through. How can I help? Not, oh, I get it because I did this and check out my sob story, you know? And that was just personally, is a very beautiful trait. And really the amount of people that I've talked to just at shows or even just fans of people that were at CRB or even Ryan or whatever, known him forever, just through that, they all have some story where they talked with him in a parking lot or after a show or something and connected and talked about music or something. And then he would get their phone number and, like, you know, on a pretty consistent basis, be like, hey man, I know you were trying to check out whatever, this style of music. Why don't you check out this record or look at this producer or look at this musician? And he did that with everybody. So many people I talked to were like, I hardly knew the guy, but he would text me every 2 weeks with like a list of records that I should get. And I would get them and they'd all be great. And like, it was this relationship we had that wasn't very personal, but it felt close because he cared, because he took the time to wake up and do whatever he's doing and go, oh right, this person, out of all the people that he was in touch with, he'd go like that, oh right, you know, this person, I just heard a record or something, or I just found a record in my collection that this person would love, I'm going to send him a picture of it and say, this is, you know, check this out. That kind of attention was a rare thing, and it was a gift for everybody. And as far as music, I think he just had the biggest ears. He was just a listener. And he would try and do his whatever the best he could to sound like whatever he thought he had to sound like. But he always ended up sounding like himself, which is great. And he studied music in a way that I've never seen. He was so knowledgeable, not just about the music itself, but like the event. What was going on that day in time, what was happening, where the studio was, what kind of mood the band was in, all this sort of lore, you know, all that stuff. He loved that shit, which was a part of why I was so surprised at what happened, because I know he's a big legacy guy. Everything that's, you know, he's such a Stones guy. He knows every story about every record, what was going on, and the personal dramas and the studio and who's sleeping with whose girlfriend and whatever, you know. And just to take yourself out, and that's your legacy to an extent, was really something that I was really angry about for, and still am for, you know. I know how, what attention to detail he pays into the lives of people that do this. And to have that be his last word to me really felt really out of character for him.
We're going to leave it there. Circles Around the Sun tour continues. A bunch of dates in March and in April. And thank you for continuing with Circles Around the Sun. It's a real treat to listen to how this band continues to evolve and make amazing music, not just in the studio, but also live. And Adam, thanks again for taking the time and always being there when we call on you.
Yeah, well, I wasn't today. I'm sorry about that.
No. Well, it's fine. You were ultimately. It's fine. It's all good. Thanks, dude.
Yeah, great to talk to you.
There you have it. A thorough understanding of where Circles Around the Sun is at post-Neil Cassell's passing. The self-titled record is truly great if you're into instrumental jammy music, and it's a very strong send-off for Cassell. While Cassell's legacy will certainly live on through this band and other soon-to-be-released projects, the show must go on. Circles Around the Sun continue to tour, and early reports indicate that the revolving guitar chair spot is being filled admirably by people like Eric Krasno and Scott Metzger. We certainly wish Adam, Dan, and Mark the very best as they continue their audio journey without their dear friend Neil Casal. You can pre-order the record and check out more tour dates at circlesaroundthesun.com. Before we leave you, let's listen to another cut off the new record. Here is Leaving, Rouge Lemon.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.